Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network since 2009. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome back to Saved by the Bellini, the podcast. I am John DeBerry, and this is a podcast where we give a little bit behind-the-scenes look into the creation of my cocktail book, Saved by the Bellini, which is a love letter to the 90s as told through cocktail recipes. And this next interview is with a legendary bartender, Toby Cecchini, who is the inventor of the Cosmopolitan, but not everyone thinks so. And the story as to why is super fascinating. And, you know, for those of you who don't know about the Cosmopolitan, it's one of the most iconic 90s cocktails. I do have a Cosmopolitan in Saved by the Bellini, of course. And so he, that recipe and, you know, his influence on bartending is impossible to deny. And so I want to bring him on and talk about the creation of this drink and why people think that other people created it who aren't him, and also what drinks were like in the 90s, because I think everyone thinks that they were not great, but that might not be true. So give it a listen. Cheers. Yeah, the reason why I wanted you to join me was because you are kind of widely credited as the creator of the Cosmopolitan.
Maybe not widely enough.
Yes, that's why we're here. But, you know, when I first started bartending, there was this one story about a bartender in Florida,
yeah.
Cheryl something, yeah. who was listed in like the PDT, like Rolodex, like literally. And that's who I thought it was.
Gary Regan found her.
Yeah.
Like somehow in the woodwork.
And then there was like the Dale was the one who served the Cosmopolitan to Madonna, and that was sort of part of it.
Not true.
And I don't know if that's even true or not. So exactly. So what's the real story?
I mean, the real story, it's very funny how this has come full circle.
Yeah.
Because I made up the Cosmopolitan when I was 25 working at the Odeon in Tribeca downtown. And for years and years, as this thing grew and grew and grew and got its own life, it literally was a drink that I cobbled together for the waitresses that I worked with.
Wow.
This woman that I worked with named Melissa Huffsmith, who was this kind of hardcore chick, was in like an all-girl punk band and heroin addict at a point. And she was pretty awesome, pretty rough customer, but I liked her a lot. She went out one night with a bunch of friends from California, and she's like, hey, we were at Life Cafe on Tompkins Square Park last night. My friends who are bartenders in California showed me this drink that's kind of like they knew from like gay bars in San Francisco. It's called the Cosmopolitan, and it's made like this. It's rail vodka with Rose's lime juice and Rose's grenadine.
Okay.
And a twist of lemon. And I was like, oh. In a, you know, one of those up V-shaped martini glasses. And I was like, well, you know, that's cute. That's really gross.
That's gross.
And I was like, you know, I can do better than that. And so I was just messing around with things. And we had just a couple months prior been sort of offered on a Salvor Absolute Citron, which had just come out. I think that the first flavored Absolute was the pepper.
Wow.
Like the year prior. And then Citron came out and we were like, dude, no way. Like the flavor is inside the vodka. This is 1988. We just thought it was like the coolest thing ever. And yeah, we had no idea what to do with it. We tried making martinis with it. They were grotesque. We were just like, this is super cool, I'm sure. But like, what do we do with it? And so we just kind of sat around for a while and kept trying different things, like sort of throwing things at the wall. So when I was like, oh, I want to redo this drink. I was like, let me use that cool stuff, that new stuff. And so I just, you know, used Citron. And we were doing margaritas with Cointreau and fresh lime juice at the Odeon at that time, which seems like duh now,
right.
But was somewhat unusual.
Pretty groundbreaking.
Yeah, I mean, people were basically doing margaritas with you know, margarita mix out of a gun,
right.
Like squirt mix, whatever it was. And so Keith McNally, who was kind of otherwise the devil, would still, you know, insisted we do our margaritas with real tequila and fresh lime juice and Cointreau. And so we had those in the house and we were used to using them. So I was like, yeah, that's kind of the backbone. Like, I'll use this with Cointreau and then balance it out with lime. And then I need something to make it red and I don't want to use Rose's grenadine because that's gross. Basically just high fructose corn syrup with fake red dye in it. So we were doing Cape Codders there and I just grabbed the cranberry and, you know, dolloped it in
like
there.
Ocean Spray or what?
Ocean Spray cranberry juice cocktail, like the actual original, which it has, you know, has also come full circle because I read in your book that you're like, make this, you know, like cranberry coulis with black tea and whatnot. Like, I also have tried a million different iterations and I can't necessarily, you can make a lot of different things, but it's like, I've done like, you know, organic cranberry and this and that. I've done my own cranberry sort of coulis with fresh cranberries and,
wow.
And making it, you know, correcting it for acid with malic and citric acids. And I'm just like, dude, this is not necessarily better than the Cosmo the way I just threw it together when I was 25. Like, it's a different thing, and it's sharper, and it's this and that. And now I'm using gin, or now I'm using Blanc Armagnac, and now I'm doing this and that. But it's just like, the Cosmopolitan is the Cosmopolitan. You know,
yeah.
Like, you can say Negroni's only a Negroni if you do this, but then you can swap out all these different parts. I'm kind of all for that. But in all these different versions that I've tried to, people are like, we want you to do an event where you do the original Cosmo and then you do like a new Cosmo for us. And then I'll like whip together some new fancified, you know, like aughts version of the Cosmo or like, you know, like 2010s version or whatever. And I'm like, huh. And people are like, I kind of like the original one better. And I'm like, I can't really fault you for that.
Yeah.
It's a very simple sour. And when you make it to my actual spec, it's very kind of dry and tart and adult.
Great. Yeah.
I mean, it's been bastardized beyond belief in the ensuing, whatever the hell it's been, 35 years, right? 35 years, is that right?
Yeah, something like that.
And also, so this thing happened. Let me get back to my point. So I have been sort of forced to own my own drink after a long period of time. When this, you know, like made its exodus from the Odeon to up West Broadway to then around lower downtown and then literally around all downtown and then for the next 2 years throughout New York City from like 88 to 91, it was just literally, we were like slaves chained to a boot blacking machine. Like we were just, I was turning out 250 of these things a night and every other bartender too. And every bartender in New York was like, you are that son of a bitch. You know, and I'm like, and I was like, what? I don't even know what you're talking about even. And they're like, no. So-and-so, Derek Greer, who works at the Odeon, told me you invented this fucking drink. And I'm like, dude, wasn't even me or anything. Like, I just tried to disown it for years and years and years.
That's until
the cocktail renaissance came in like 2000.
Yeah.
And then everybody, like Gary Regan and like everyone else, is searching for like, you know, sort of prima facie, like who made these drinks? Who really made the martini? Who made the old fashioned? Who was the real inventor of the Manhattan? Blah, blah, blah. They're like, well, there's one drink we know. You know, I think we know that Tom Cicchini, but Gary Regan was like, listen, like you tell this story, you took this drink from like this super shabby, like rail vodka drink that was making the rounds in like gay leather bars in San Francisco in the late 70s, apparently.
Right.
And you then sort of reinvented it. So you didn't really invent it. Somebody else invented it. I'm like, well, Gary, he's like, I'm trying to find real inventor. And I'm like, you found the real inventor.
Yeah.
Like that was a non-drink. And I made it into an actual drink. Like the version that you know and the world knows, that's my drink. My mistake, in hindsight, is that I didn't rename it.
Exactly.
So therein lies your lesson. Rename your drink when you completely reconfigure a drink. And
call it something else.
And make it a lot better. Call it something else.
Yeah.
But I was just like, whatever. I mean, I made it for the waitresses and they were like, oh my God, this is delicious.
So it didn't even go on the menu?
No, never.
Wow.
Never.
Why not?
It was like our little secret house
drink. It was like a fun little
I mean, not even our like,
snackery.
I wasn't drinking them, but I was making them for the whole staff, and it became this thing for months. It was like our house drink, and then it was very strange that like when our regulars started coming and being like, "Hey, can you make me a Cosmopolitan?" I'm like, "Wait, how do you know about that? That's like our little secret drink." And it's like, "Oh, well, Thais told me about it," and then people I didn't even know who weren't even our regulars would start asking for it. I'm like, "Wait, who are you? How do you know that drink?" They're like, "Oh, well, Donald Sultan told me about it." And it was like, I actually saw the sort of...
The network.
I saw the wires happening, yeah.
That's so cool. Because now you go on Instagram or TikTok and it's just like, boom.
Yeah, that didn't exist.
Yeah, obviously.
Pre all that. And it was very weird. And so it like just caught wildfire in downtown New York for like 2 years. And I think, you know, Dale sort of discovered it like 2-3 years later.
Yeah.
Sort of uptown. And this whole thing of like Cheryl Cook is just madness. It's just some chick that Gary Regan put out an all points bulletin, like trying to find who really invented the Cosmopolitan. So this like, like this one and tons of other people just kind of crawled out of the woodwork and were like, I did. Like some guy in Michigan, some guy in like Augusta, Georgia. So like all these people, like 12 different people from all over. Like I invented the Cosmopolitan. It's just like, no, you didn't.
Do you think that they think that they invented it, or do you think that was sort of like a bad faith, like...
the stories are pretty... I mean, when you start actually reading their stories, you're like... And so, in kind of a good move, when Absolut was purchased by Pernod Ricard from the Swedish government or whoever had it before... they decided that they're like gonna like lean into the Cosmopolitan, and you know this is a drink that's made with their product, so they're gonna lean into it. So they have to find out the real story, like who actually invented this. There's all these people out there. So they sent a journalist from London. Like they first made inquiries. They're like, "We're told that you maintain that you invented the Cosmopolitan." I mean, I got an email, and I was like, "Yes, I do." They're like, "Well, we're sending a journalist from England to take everyone's story down, and we're going to sort of corroborate them against the sort of facts of the history of the Cosmopolitan as we know it. Would you be willing to talk to this person?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure." So I actually sent Jacob, I'm thinking Jacob Greer, what's his name? Jacob, he owns the Museum of Gin in London, and he has a gin label now. Very cool guy. Former bartender, and he like just went around America talking to everybody who maintained that they had invented the Cosmopolitan, and he's like, "Just tell me your story." And I told him the story, and he's like, "What are the dates? What this and that?" And then, you know, like a couple months later, they're like, "Congratulations, you're the only person whose story actually checks out with like all the dates of Absolut releasing Citron and blah blah blah." And I was like,
"Yeah, I know."
Well, obviously, because it's my drink, by the way. You know, like, why am I having to prove this? But somehow I'm having to prove it. And ever since then, it's just been this constant ongoing thing where, like, Tepchkini purported, like, who maintains that he's the inventor of the Cosmopolitan. I'm like, "No, like, I don't maintain it. I invented the Cosmopolitan." Like,
what do you have to do to prove?
I always joke with Sammy Ross about this. I'm like, "Do you have to constantly, like, reprove that, you know, paper planes is yours and
penicillin?"
And it's just like, no, because you gave them proper names, you know, like, I didn't do that, and so I'm forever paying my penance.
Yeah. I mean, I think it also has something to do with, like, in what, the penicillin's like 06?
Yeah.
Right? So there's some level of internet.
Right. And he was also amidst a bunch of cocktail bartenders while doing it.
Who could be like, yes.
Where I was just on the floor at the Odeon. And, you know, there are waitresses who I made it for who were like, "Yeah." Like, you know, Absolut talked to Betsy Canna, one of my co-workers, and she was like, "Yeah, I was there. He did that. We drank them by the pitcher." You know, like, that was happening. He did that.
Did you have to do what was your R&D process? So like you were given kind of like the back of the napkin spec of like it's these three ingredients, right? From your server who was like, "I had the Cosmopolitan, and it's like roses, grenadine, roses, lime, and vodka."
Oh, she made the original one. She made it for me, and I was like, "Oh, that's gross." And I was like, and I just sort of stored it in my head. I was like, "Dude, I could do that better." But then, you know, went through my shift.
Right.
And then at the end of the shift, I was like, "Oh, let's take a shot at that. Let me take a shot at that drink."
Yeah.
And I was just like, "I want to use this stuff. I want to use that lemon vodka." And so I started with that. And I was like, "Now I need, okay, I'm just going to use lime juice. And then I'll use Cointreau because I need to sweeten it."
Right.
I'm like, "Okay, I mean, we're basically done, except I need to make it red. I mean, it was literally that. I didn't, you know.
Yeah.
It was no more thought than that. It was like the work of 5 minutes.
That's amazing.
I mean, that's how you do. Like, that's how we do. We've all made 14 million drinks that way.
Yeah.
It's just that I happened to make one that then took on this crazy life of its own over the next few decades.
Yeah.
And here we are. And people were like, there's no way. Like, people say that, like, I just read on, you know, like Wikipedia that you're supposed to have invented the Cosmopolitan. Like, you're way too young. Like, what? And I'm like, really? When was the first time you had a Cosmo? They're like, I don't know, like 2007? I'm like, yeah, well, I invented it 20 years before that. So I don't know what you want me to say. They're like, people are just like, what? It's. I mean, I never refer to it. I just never try to refer to it. But I will defend myself because it's like, wait a minute. This has been the albatross around my neck for 35 years. But it is at least my albatross.
Right.
I mean, like, now people are trying to take it away and be like, come on. Like, you know, like, I had to live this down forever.
Yeah.
And now people are trying to, you know, like, rewrite history.
Totally. And it definitely had this, like, I don't know what they were drinking in Sex and the City, but that's not
Cosmopolitan. To this day, I've never actually seen an episode of Sex and the City.
Well, I've seen a couple. And they drink, it basically looks like the drink that your colleague brought to you.
Yeah,
it looks like a Negroni almost, yeah.
The thing about Sex and the City that is difficult for people are like, well, Sex and the City really put that on the map. And I'm like, that's not exactly the timeline. Sex and the City came out exactly 10 years, was released 10 years after I made that drink.
Yeah.
So like, there was this huge, like meteoric, like landing of that drink in downtown New York after I made it, like a year after I made it, and for the next 2-3 years. And then it just died this complete natural death of New York things where it's like, oh my God, are you kidding? That's so 1991.
Yeah.
Get out of here, like Cosmo. You know, like, and it just died. And like, we couldn't bury it fast enough because as a bartender, you were so sick of that drink. But it died. So that like 5 years later, you were like, a Cosmopolitan? Somebody just asked me for a Cosmopolitan. You know, and then
throwback.
It was just like this little New York thing that had just remained that. And then suddenly, I remember bartending in 98 and being just like, what in the hell is going on? Like, everybody's ordering Cosmopolitans again. And somebody being like, oh, there's this show on TV where like these chicks are drinking your drink.
Constantly.
I'm like, that is so weird. And it just, it just took on.
And I don't know if in this show, I mean, I haven't done a close viewing of the entire show, but like, I don't think they ever actually talk about what that drink actually is. It's just like a Cosmo. It's like a prop.
Yeah. Right.
They're not like, oh, I'm going to go make like 1 1/4 ounces of this. And then, you know, they don't give you specs. They don't break down what's in it. It's just sort of materializes.
I'm sure if you ask Candace Bushnell what the spec of a Cosmo is, she would have no idea. I mean, I'm not sure.
What is your spec for a Cosmo?
My spec for a Cosmo. So, yeah, I mean, there's sort of two versions, the 1980s version, which is like an aquarium full, or the current version that cleaves more to like the specific volume of, you know, cocktail coupes that we use nowadays. But in either case, the ratio is the same. It's 2-1-1-1. So it's 2 absolute citron to 1 full part or 1 ounce. Like when I made these, it was originally ounces. So it was like a 5-ounce cocktail shaken. Yeah. But now I make it, you know, 1 1/2, 3/4, 3/4, 3/4.
Okay.
So 1 1/2 absolute citron to 3/4 ounce of fresh lime juice, 3/4 ounce of Cointreau, and 3/4 ounce of Ocean Spray. Cranberry juice cocktail, yeah. Which, you know, I just kind of insist on the original because I'm like, that's how I made it and that's how it works. I mean, I've tried all these other things. You can do any number of other things.
Right.
You can swap in Grey Goose lemon. You can do this. You can do that. You can use, you know, any other type of triple sec. But, you know, I'm sorry to say, because $45 a liter is tough to swallow for the price of Cointreau. But I just feel like, dude, I made it with Cointreau. And Cointreau still, to me, is the best triple sec. People love Boudier. Like, I mean, or Combier, I mean. I mean, where do you come down on that?
I'm a Cointreau girl.
Yeah, I just think it's amazing.
It's good.
I mean, it's dry. It's got like two kinds. It's got like both sweet and bitter orange peel in it. It's really just like you try other triple secs, even ones that you think should be surprisingly good, like Giffard and whatnot, and you're like, oh my God, this doesn't hold a candle.
I mean, like, the only other triple sec that I really love is I mean, it's not really even triple sec. It's Blue Curacao and Senior Curacao, but that's kind of a different beast.
Yeah.
Were there like other, like, so it seemed like this drink like had this kind of like almost like a viral sensation phenomenon among like industry people in New York. Were there other drinks that were that did this, or was it just something about this like
in that era?
Were there drinks alongside the Cosmopolitan that were like kind of, you know, taking Lower Manhattan by storm that just never actually survived?
Not that I can really think of. I mean, like, it was rudimentary. We were using rocks and sticks to make drinks back then.
Did you have lights back then?
We really weren't, actually. This is the weird thing. This is why you have a 107-year-old man in your studio right now. Yeah. Because, like, all this, like, sort of revisionist history of, like, the cocktail renaissance, like, brought cocktails to the benighted. Like, right. They were amazing bartenders when I was, like, a stripling starting as a bartender at, like, 23 years old, 25, whatever I was. And there were like much older bartenders around me who I would go to all these bars around New York, and they were making amazing cocktails and, you know, like doing beautiful things. And these people never get spoken of, never get remembered. It's really like Dale DeGroff and Sacha Petrosky put cocktails on the map out of thin air. It's like, it didn't really happen that way. Like there were like hundreds and hundreds of great bartenders in this town practicing through the 70s, 80s, everything. It's just like this thing was all incremental. Like people were doing, I mean, the 90s were all about vodka.
Yeah.
Just all about, what am I trying to say? Macerations in vodka.
It was like flavored vodkas.
Yeah, like flavored vodkas. Like making your own, like dozens and dozens of M4A behind the bar.
With, like you do it yourself.
And ginger and like that was the cool thing in the 90s. You'd walk into like every restaurant, and every bar, and it was just like all these glass urns full of berries and fruits and herbs and whatnot with like vodka, like all these flavored vodkas. That's what, like, it was just everywhere in the early 90s.
That's so interesting.
All it was.
Yeah.
And nobody ever talks about that now. And you just wrote a book about it, and you're sort of surprised.
Well, I wrote a book about the 90s as like a way of exploring like pop culture in general. Not necessarily like I didn't really want to touch like 90s drinks, like what people were drinking back then, because like for me, like, I don't know, drink history is sort of like kind of interesting, but to me it's more like let's talk about what we're drinking now and like have a fun reference to like Jurassic Park or like Melrose Place or whatever. And I knew that any kind of like trying to have like a definitive history of what people were drinking in the 90s was probably going to be incomplete and kind of a failure.
Right.
So I decided to like sidestep that very cleverly just to save my own credibility. But this is kind of why I'm doing this, because I'm so curious to hear from, because I think a lot of it, like this, the kind of like the orthodoxy of like, you know, I was a bartender and I started bartending at PDT in like 2006. No, sorry, 2008. And it was like, oh, we're coming out of the dark ages, and it's like, you know, Death & Co. and like, you know, Audrey's Bar, Pegu Club, you know, Pegu, these places were like
Flatiron.
Yeah. Like, this was like sort of like,
these were like the beacons in the night.
Yeah.
But, I mean, and those places were all great bars, but it just didn't come out of thin air. Like there has always been such a culture of cocktail making in New York City and in San Francisco and in London and all these other places. And so there are now these key characters. I think in a way it becomes who shouts the loudest after a while. Like,
true,
gets the history. But there, I knew so many great bartenders when I was coming up, and like they were much older than me, and I was super young. And like looking at guys in their 50s and women in their 40s who were just spectacular bartenders. And I'm like, they're never spoken of now. Nobody knows their names. Nobody knows where they were. You know, like, where are they now? Like, who knows? But there were people doing great, great stuff.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and be right back.
All right.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City, Long Island, and Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
So you're talking about like all of these bartenders and all of this like bar culture and like these great bartenders mm-hmm. Who were doing what they were doing in the 90s. Like what, I mean, this may be kind of, I don't know if this is like a rude question, but like, what do you think, like, where did they go? Because it's like, it seemed like all those people, they didn't get jobs at the super fancy cocktail speakeasies that everyone was.
No, super... they were abducted by aliens. I mean, yeah, I think people exactly. aged out at that point. See, when I started, bartending was still kind of an ill-viewed thing. It was right. like, oh, you're still waiting tables, waiting for your break
yeah.
as a writer or an actor or an artist.
So as soon as you could get out.
As soon as you could get out, else. Like you got out and you never spoke of it again. Or right. you like when you found a real job, quote unquote. Right. And that's very much what I was doing for a right. long time. And you know, it took it. I you know, I've told this story a million times, but it took going to Italy and seeing my uncle there, who was sort of this sort of patriarch of our of that family side in Italy, and he was like, you know, what are you doing with yourself these days? I'm like, oh, kind of, you know, it's embarrassing, but I'm tending bar right now, and I, you know, like I'm thinking of going to law school. I'll have a real job soon.
And, yeah. Oh, hey, I did the law school thing too.
Yeah, and he like came out of a bag on me, like just was. Thunderously angry at me.
He wow.
was like, how dare you speak of a job like that? Like, if you're not doing the absolute best you can do in a job, there's no job that's beneath you. Like, but he just, like, screamed at me.
Oh, I love
like,
that.
And he was like my Uncle Giuliano, who's this incredibly sweet man who I've never seen him angry. And I was just like, the hair on the back of my neck stood up. I was like, holy God. Like, Giuliano just, like, chewed me out. And I was like, and it made me sort of think and think and think for days. And I was like, you know, he said, like, you do the job you're doing, you do it as absolutely well as you can, and that's the only way you'll supersede it and move on to something better.
Right.
And I was like, you know, Giuliano's kind of right in that, like, I consider this job beneath me, and so when I kind of look at what I do, I'm sort of a shit bartender. Like, I'm sort of snotty to people, and I won't clean up their napkins, and I'm like, oh, you're making a mess, and I'm just like, I'm sort of a half-ass, like, snotty bartender because I sort of consider this job beneath me. I was like, what if I actually embraced the job
right.
and tried to be a really good bartender? What would that be like? Like, I don't have to, like, be bartending still. I remember saying, like, if I'm still a bartender when I'm 40, I'll kill myself. Okay, well, that was 20 years ago.
Yeah. But,
so, like, that was my initial thing. Like, don't be afraid of, like, being too good at this and, like, staying in it.
Yeah.
But, like, actually put yourself at it and try to be a good bartender. And I was like, oh, it's like night and day. Like, I just was, like, it was making the realization that it was, like, I was actually really shit at what I was trying to do, like sort of affecting to try to do.
Yeah.
But when you actually put yourself into something whole, you know, like wholly in thought and deed, it's a much bigger thing.
Yeah. I love that.
And, you know, I'm not saying that like the cocktail renaissance didn't sort of change everything. Like,
right.
I was making really good drinks from the time I opened. I mean, from the time I was at Kin Cow in the 90s, and then certainly when I opened Passerby in 99. Which was the year before Sasha opened Milk and Honey, and yeah. we, you know, we sort of would talk about that. And but you know, his take was like, "Oh, it's only you and I like doing these kind of drinks." I'm like, "No, it's a lot of people actually. It's you know, like Milk and Honey was an amazing, amazing thing
yeah.
and groundbreaking, and so was Death and Company. When I went to Death and Company, I was like, "Wow, this is wild!" Like I've been doing things very much in my own way, without any contact with other bartenders, and like. Just reading books and doing this and that, but like these kids are doing amazing stuff
yeah.
in very different ways from the way I did. And so this is kind of equal parts humiliating and fascinating to me. Like I'm looking at what things they're doing and I'm like, why am I using a Boston shaker? These like 1828 tins are so much lighter and so much like this is really cool. Like incorporating things that I was seeing and I was just like, wow, I've been doing this for 20 years and I've been doing things not wrong exactly, but like there are better
Could be
ways.
Better.
Like
yeah.
you've got other people with better ideas, then look at those ideas and incorporate them. Like there a lot came out of the cocktail renaissance that has like completely changed the path of what we do. And a big part of it was the internet and another big part of it was the sort of rise in esteem of the entire
right.
profession. It's like
yeah.
with the rise in esteem of chefs, I think came the rise in esteem of the whole industry, and certainly something as singular as those men and women behind the bar, like doing their potion mixery, and people were like, that's kind of cool. And so people actually started taking it seriously as a job.
Yeah.
And that was a big, big change.
Yeah, that definitely was something I experienced where I really wanted to work at PDT because it was a really cool bar.
Right.
And I was kind of like, oh, I went to a fancy Ivy League school. Like, I'm supposed to go to law school. I'll just do this for a little minute. And then, like, I was realizing that I was like definitely this job is not beneath me. And like, there are people way smarter than me who worked way harder than me who've been doing this for longer than I have. And I'm like,
Don Lee and John DeBell.
Yeah, exactly. I was like basically roommates with Don Lee in college. That's how I got that job. And so, and it was like, I was among people who like were doing this job as their careers. And it was just like, became very, very, very clear early on that this could be a real career. Uh-huh. And I just didn't ever look back. And I have a few people who were like, oh, so what do you really want to do? Like, what's your real job? But I think I only got asked that like a few times. And
I heard that 1,000 times. You seem like a smart guy.
What are you actually trying
to do in life? Yeah.
This is it. Yeah. Although I did get one sassy comment from my grandfather who said, he was a professor at Columbia, and he was like, I told him that I got this job. I was working at PDT and Momofuku, and I was explaining to him like what I was doing, and he's like, so I see you're putting your Columbia education to good use. And I'm like, cool, grandpa, bye.
I mean,
and then I'm the first of his grandchildren to publish a book.
Look, as an arbiter of dad jokes, I actually applaud your grandfather.
it was pretty sassy. It was funny. I will give him that. So yeah, it sounds almost like it's like, instead of it being this like, you know, sticks and stones, dark ages period, that like just the 90s and before even like were this kind of laid this sort of groundwork of like of culture and skills that then when this esteem rose in the next decade, it became almost like a perfect storm.
You know, every people. Generation thinks it's reinventing the wheel,
right.
Of course,
yeah.
and needs to slay its elders and whatnot. But
yeah.
I mean, there is a real sort of arc.
Yeah.
There's a very real trajectory. And having witnessed a lot more of it than I think a lot of people in the industry right now,
yeah,
I see that. And it's just like the people who like blew my mind with cocktails in the 80s and 90s are not doing it anymore, and they're not named anywhere, but I knew they existed, you know.
Yeah.
That's how I got my fascination with this entire industry.
What happened to their recipes?
What did happen to their recipes? I mean, the same thing that happens with how many drinks have you made just off your cuff in your life?
I don't know.
1,400? 2,300?
Maybe less, but a good number. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've made thousands.
Yeah.
What's happened to all of them?
Right.
And arguably, you know, easily half of those better than the Cosmopolitan. And yet maybe I'll die being known for one drink.
Yeah.
You know, that I made up when I was 25 for waitresses.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm all right with that.
You're right with that.
Yeah, I'm good with that.
Saved by the Bellini is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.